This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced last week that he would be resigning. In 2002, in an article in The Spectator about how he thinks people wrongly blame British colonialism for Africa's problems, he wrote, "The continent may be a blot, but it is not a blot upon our conscience. The problem is not that we were once in charge, but that we are not in charge anymore." Our guest, historian Caroline Elkins, documents the dark side of the British Empire in her new book, Legacy of Violence, A History of the British Empire. That empire became the largest empire in history, and by 1920 included 24% of the Earth's landmass. Elkins spoke with guest interviewer Arun Venugopal, who's a senior reporter in the Race and Justice Unit at public radio station WNYC in New York. They spoke before Johnson's resignation announcement. Here's Arun with more.
This year marked the Platinum Jubilee of Elizabeth II, her 70th year as the Queen of England. It's the first time any British monarch has celebrated a Platinum Jubilee. When Queen Elizabeth II took the throne in 1952, the British Empire encompassed parts of Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and the Pacific, and included 700 million people. In her new book, our guest Caroline Elkins looks at how the use of violence was central to the spread and maintenance of the British Empire, even as it portrayed itself self-servingly as a benevolent force. The book is called Legacy of Violence, A History of the British Empire, and it explores how colonial officials from India to Malaya to South Africa hid evidence of their violent practices while building the largest empire in human history. In the 1990s, Caroline Elkins began to write her dissertation about Britain's civilizing mission during the last years of colonial rule in Kenya. But then she discovered British officials had created a vast network of secret detention camps that housed as many as 1.5 million members of Kenya's Kikuyu community. In those camps, officials practiced unimaginably sadistic forms of torture upon Kikuyu men and women, along with sexual violence. Her revelations were published in her first book, Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006. Caroline Elkins is professor of history and of African and African-American studies at Harvard University and the founding director of Harvard's Center for African Studies. And she joins us now. Caroline Elkins, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me, Arun.
Much of your book deals with the idea of liberal imperialism. What does that mean?
Yeah, liberal imperialism is Britain's civilizing mission, right? It's white man's burden. This idea that it was going to bring democracy and rule of law and free market to, you know, 700 million subjects across a quarter of the world's landmass. And, you know, all empires are violent, but it takes a particular form in the British Empire because coercion isn't just about establishing and maintaining authority over subject populations. It's actually part of reform, this idea that you have to have local populations feel suffering, to feel pain, to experience forced labor, that these, in fact, bring about a kind of developmentalism, a kind of movement into, if you will, adulthood, and eventually into independence. As Britain begins to expand its empire overseas and confronts distant places with so-called backward people, with these strange religions and dependent relationships, the question becomes, can these people with different skin colors become like us? And skin color becomes the mark of difference.
Let's talk about the moral effect that you referred to earlier. A leading British military theorist, you quote Colonel Charles Caldwell, said, "The enemy must be made to feel a moral superiority throughout." You say his approach was embraced across the empire, that it helped fuse battlefield strategies with the white man's burden. But what does it mean in practice?
You know, in practice, it means untold suffering. It means that gloves are off and that any kind of sort of coercive tactic, whether it be the use of detention camps, whether it's torture, whether it's scorched earth policy, the level of violence is extraordinary. And what it means for somebody like Caldwell is that you can explain the violence by the fact that it has a moral quality to it. It has a moral, if you will, redemptive effect. Battlefields, soldiers, colonial administrators, missionaries, many of them believed in the nature of coercion and the ways in which it was part and parcel of this civilizing mission.
British legal experts, you write, wrestled with distinctions between civilized and uncivilized. Some went so far as to create categories of civilized, barbarian, and savage. These categories, I guess, relied on all the Western anthropologists and other academics who were crisscrossing the empire, measuring skull sizes and whatnot of natives and deciding how civilized a tribe was. Scholarship was quite critical to the imperial project, wasn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And I think that the nature by which, if you will, academics, people who were, as you're saying, scholars at the time, were complicit in the colonial project, lending credence, lending sort of scholarly heft. And it's also important to bear in mind that this is an era in the 19th century of the upswing of scientific racism. And what becomes the marker of difference is skin color. Whites are at one end, and the Brits at the top of that sort of, top of the pile. On the far end of the other spectrum are blacks from Africa, with all other shades in between. And of course, the Brits and others are capable of racializing subjects, such that Afrikaners in South Africa and the Irish also become racialized, such that they are seen as being, of a lesser breed, if you will, than Anglo-Saxons in Britain.
One economist, Utsa Patnaik, who received her doctorate from Oxford, estimated that over the course of 200 years, the British siphoned off an amount of around $45 trillion from India. How did they do this?
It's a rather extraordinary arc, right? When we think about the nature of the East India Company is set up back in the early 17th century, and endures all the way into, it becomes the Raj in 1857 and endures until 1947. So you have a very long period of time. And there's all sorts of ways in which this takes place, and some of which is by establishing taxation policies, squeezing local peasants. We see some of the diamonds that are sitting that are part of the monarchy's crown jewels, as you well know, are being demanded, to have them returned. And we're talking massive sums of money. And then, of course, the East India Company and then eventually the Raj is a huge, enormous cash cow for the British Empire in a whole range of ways, whether it's from exports, whether certainly during the Second World War, many would argue that the contribution to the war effort in the Second World War by India really tipped the scales for Britain, holding back, the Japanese coming into the region. And again, costing dearly. And in fact, Britain becomes a borrower from India during wartime. And so it is of no surprise to me that we see that kind of number. And the question, of course, that it raises is what accounting has to take place in the here and now for that? And arguments are made from other parts of the empire in a similar fashion.
It's not unusual, even these days, to hear about, I guess, the benefits of empire upon a place like India. Oh, we gave them the railroads, the gift of English, when in fact the British, or the rather the Indian economy, was something like 25%, I think, of the world's GDP in the 18th century, and then about 3% when the Brits left. It's an enormous disconnect from the reality of what happened, right?
Absolutely. And we can take that, and once Britain, quote unquote, loses India in 47, Malaya steps in and becomes the cash cow in the post-war period. And, I just think that the degree to which we, understand this period of time and the degree to which these colonies are extremely important, to, as I said, both the material and the social and nationalistic views of empire. But I think we also have to step back for a moment. If we think about empire as a balance sheet, right, we add it up on both sides, like a ledger, all the good, all the bad. At the end of the day, the conversation doesn't get us very far, in my view. And I think where we need to sort of move ourselves in the direction of is to accept, to be frank, as historical fact, that this was a course of empire, that it drained enormous resources. And I think this question about liberal imperialism, the nature of reform and coercion, it makes it very hard to have arguments about violence and exploitation stick if we don't see that we have both coercion and reform as two sides of the same coin. And that's really what I think I'm trying to get at in what is a rather lengthy but troubling story that unfolds over about 800 pages or so.
The U.S. essentially becomes the dominant world power in the 20th century. Did it also practice similar sort of, a paradox of, you know, upholding freedoms, certain liberties, while at the same time, you know, maintaining in the same way that British Empire had a coercive tactic against non-white populations?
Sure. I mean, we can certainly see this. We can take it in turn, right? Both internationally and domestically. Internationally, with our counterinsurgency policies, we quite literally took the book from Britain. Sir Robert Thompson was sent over from Malaya to advise the Johnson, Kennedy, Nixon administrations in Vietnam. Strategic Hamlet is taken directly from villagization policies with all the kinds of terror and dislocation and suffering that come along with it. And we can go all the way down to the present day to Iraq and Afghanistan, right? When we think about the ways in which the Petraeus Report looks to Britain, say they got counterinsurgency right in places like Malaya. And what I'm saying is, depends on what you mean by right, but certainly these are incredibly, incredibly coercive systems. So this notion of hearts and minds campaigns that the United States ostensibly brings to the rest of the world, today we call it freedom and democracy, whatever the case may be, comes directly from Britain. And then, of course, domestically, when we also think about the ways in which we deal with so-called, quote-unquote, subject populations in the United States, those who are not some of the original, sort of, if you're an originalist with our Constitution, thinking about those who sort of wrote that and were benefiting from it back at the founding of our own nation. And we certainly see the similar kinds of ways in which exclusion and inclusion happens under the banner of liberalism, and they're able to get away with it. And we see that happening all the way down to the present day.
Something that seems to go completely unremarked upon is that the U.S. went from fighting for its freedom from Britain and fought it again in the War of 1812. And yet eventually these two countries become extremely close allies. We refer to the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain. What's special about this relationship?
Let's start our story for now, sort of around the time of World War II. And obviously, you know, the legendary relationship between Churchill and FDR. And FDR always sort of looked a little askance at Churchill, you know, thought he was a Tory, a real Tory of the old sort.
What does that mean?
Well, that means, you know, really, in many ways, sort of believing in sort of the hierarchical nature of rule, of the exceptionalism of Britain, of the ways in which white population should be dominating throughout the world. And FDR, we so often, you know, associate him with the Four Freedoms and the like, and he was dogmatic about wanting to dismantle the British Empire after the Second World War. Now, what we see is that Second World War comes to a close and the opposite happens. And in part, this happens because the United States needs Britain in the emerging Cold War. And so eventually we see the United States not only allowing Britain, turning a blind eye to what's going on, but actually co-opting them and having them assist the United States. For British Guiana would be a great example where, you know, Britain is basically doing the dirty work for the Americans. And we see this playing out over time, and we can then fast forward it all the way up to, you know, New Labour under Tony Blair and George W. Bush, and folks scratching their head about how could these two be such bedfellows, and it's no surprise whatsoever. And literally the language that Tony Blair uses at the time is that we are executing a quote unquote new liberal imperialism, and they are joined at the hip with the United States. And so this special relationship is such that make no mistake, it's uneasy at times. Certainly there are times when the United States is really pushing hard to dismantle the Sterling area, to really insert itself as sort of the dominant economic force in the world. But this special relationship continues, and much of it, some of it at least, rests on these shared notions of racial hierarchy, on these shared notions of global dominance, and certainly of maintaining a stronghold against the rising Cold War in the Soviet Union.
In recent years, the debate over Western history and colonial sins has broken out of academic circles, and it's pretty much gone mainstream. I'd like to play a clip. It's a little raucous, but it's from the TV show Good Morning Britain, and it primarily features a black historian, Kehinde Andrews, engaging in a back and forth with Piers Morgan and other hosts, all of whom, I should add, are white. Let's hear that.
The reality is that the history of this country is built on racism. And therefore, everybody involved in it, it probably has a really racist past. And
this is a problem.
I admit this is a problem for you.
My problem, you're a smart guy. My problem is when smart people like you basically say this country was built on racism.
It was.
It's full of racism.
Do you mean
and remains racist, right?
Do you mean because it's built on colonialism?
That's a really good argument.
I have a problem with that position. I think it's a load of old baloney when you say that.
What?
I think it's a great country, right?
You have to, I know, and you have to say that. I understand why
you like this country.
I'm not going to be told to feel ashamed of my country. It's because you say we're a bunch of
racists. Just a minute, Piers. Just a minute. Otherwise, I don't get to say anything, Piers. Just calm down, right? Why don't you like living in this country?
Why don't I like living in this country?
Because
this
is, I think, you know...
Why do you live in this country?
The unfortunate truth is that my parents, my family were taken to slavery to the Caribbean and had to migrate here because they were so poor in the Caribbean.
But what am I...
not my choice.
Why do you still live here when you're a successful man? You've got enough money to live somewhere else. Why do you live in this country?
And this is the problem with Churchill. This colonialism, imperialism has ruined the other parts of the world around going.
That's not my question. Everything this country stands for?
I don't hate this country, but I do.
Well, you said that you believe we're a racist country, built on racism, and remain racist.
Yep.
Why would you,
that's a good summary.
A black man who has the means to leave the country, why would you stay here?
Good morning, Britain, for you.
Defensive much?
Not at all. I mean, what struck me, the first thing was that they, on a morning show like this, I guess it's similar to Good Morning America, is that here the hosts use a black historian's criticisms of imperialism as an excuse basically to ask him, why doesn't it just go somewhere else?
Well, that in and of itself should tell you something, right? And I think all joking aside, it's a perfect clip. And even that statement, why don't you go somewhere else? Beginning in 1948, Britain instituted a set of policies to basically create a kind of imperial citizenship as they were beginning to lose their empire. Over the course of several decades, that does a complete turnaround, right? 180 degrees, such that immigration laws become tighter and tighter in Britain. We see a deliberate effort to, if you will, under sort of the banner of the Tory party at one point, you know, to keep Britain white. And I raised this question in my book about this through line, right? And this question going back around to our conversation about developmentalism, the idea that one day you two, brown and black subjects, will be like us. But I raised this question of saying, for many in Britain, not all, but for many, the question remains, can these brown and black subjects or former subjects really be British? And you just heard the answer to that, which is no, right? If you don't like it here, go somewhere else. And I think in that sense, it's a real, if you will, colonial reckoning. It's a kind of reckoning that we see in Britain. It's a kind of reckoning, and is similar to draw the parallels that we see happening in the United States. In this developmentalist model, can these populations be like us? And of course, developmentalism is always built around this principle of they'll be like us one day, but not yet. Just not yet. And you know what, Arun? Not yet never comes. Recently, there was a Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities report, 2021. And, you know, look, it found in the report that, quote unquote, there's no systematic or institutional racism. He went on, the report goes on to describe empire and the rest. And it talks about how, you know, it says that there's a new story about the Caribbean experiences that speaks to the slave period of not only being about profit and suffering, but how culturally African people transform themselves and remodel themselves as African and to Britain. And, I mean, think about what that report says. It's saying that slavery was kind of a good thing because it made them British. And this is happening in 2021.
When did Britain become first involved in colonizing Kenya?
Yeah, I mean, Britain became involved in colonizing East Africa at the end of the 19th century, and it's really in the 20th century that it moves from the East African protectorate and establishes Kenya as being sort of a standalone colony. And Kenya became what became the quintessential settler colony. Settlers were brought in. It was on their sort of backs and sort of their privilege that large plantations were established for the growth of tea and coffee, and land was taken from local Africans in order to do that. what became very famous was sort of the White Highlands, and the White Highlands was some of the very best land in Kenya, which of course became exclusively white. None of the local population could own or cultivate this land outside of the plantations owned by European settlers. And of course, Britain remains in Kenya from that period of time all the way until 1963, when it gains its independence after what was one of the bloodiest wars in the history of the British Empire, the Mau Mau Emergency. It's during that period of time that Britain detained nearly the entire Kikuyu population of nearly 1.5 million in order to suppress this uprising that was demanding Ithaca na Wiyathi, or land and freedom. And it was during this period of time, of course, that we see some of the most horrific systematized violence unfold, as I said, in the history of the British Empire.
When you were a graduate student setting out on your dissertation project back in the 1990s, you thought you'd be writing about the success of Britain's so-called civilizing mission during the last years of colonial rule in Kenya. It sounds like you once held the British Empire in fairly high regard. Did you?
You know, certainly the, you know, I guess we're all young and naive at one point, right, Arun? And, you know, but I think it gets back to, and certainly I wasn't so naive as to not to think that there weren't one-offs, that there wasn't violence in empire. And that's how Kenya had always been written about, right? When there were violent episodes, you explained it as an aberration, as a one-off, as a bad apple of a colonial officer. And what I came to find at the end of my research was that, no, this not only, in fact, was that not the case, but it was completely systemic. It was part and parcel of the structures of colonial rule, the ways in which coercion was infused within the civilizing mission, that these played out with dramatic and just consequential effects in Kenya. And that was a sort of an eye-opener for me. Obviously, it was about 10 years of doing research. And then the question became, which was raised with me, of is Kenya an exception? And that's how it was explained. And, you know, I don't want to get off topic, but I debated Nigel Farage around this. And Nigel Farage, is the leader of the UKIP party, very far right.
Yeah.
And he just went on and on about how Kenya was the exception. So sorry, hands up, we did terrible things, let's move on. And so I spent, about 15 years doing research, creating and writing Legacy of Violence to really answer that question. Was Kenya an aberration? And the answer to that is no.
For your first book, Imperial Reckoning, you didn't just wade through these old, dusty historical archives. You actually got to know members of the Kikuyu community. You had meals with them decades after they'd been imprisoned by the British, tortured by them as well. You also spent time at country clubs and in the suburbs of Nairobi with white settlers and missionaries and former colonial officials who would openly discuss, I guess, what happened in the detention camps with you, as you wrote, over tea or a gin and tonic served by African houseboys or waiters. What did they tell you?
It was extraordinary. You know, I think that at that time I was doing research in the 1990s, and the normative framework was still very, if you will, white colonial. And I would sit, as you said, and have their African waiters in white gloves sort of serve me a gin and tonic as the sun was setting, and they would talk about horrific forms of violence. When I say torture, that was just stomach-turning, extraordinary, like it was yesterday's weather. There was no sense that from these individuals recounting these stories to me, and this thing in particular, some former colonial officials, that they'd done anything wrong, that this was part of what they were supposed to be doing in the so-called civilizing mission, and that when they were all finished, it was declared a triumph. Many of these same colonial officers received OBEs, orders of the British Empire, from the Queen. Some, not in Kenya, but elsewhere, were knighted. And so this sense of confirming, creating a sort of historical fact out of political fiction, maintained itself, whether it was in Kenya or, back in London.
Your findings served as the basis for an unprecedented legal claim filed by five Mau Mau detention camp survivors against the British government. You also served as an expert witness in the legal proceedings. And in 2013, the British government announced a settlement with the Mau Mau claimants, offered an official apology expressing sincere regret, provided a £20 million financial payout for several thousand survivors, helped establish a monument in Nairobi dedicated to all those who were tortured during the uprising. I was struck, though, by the fact that some of the Kenyans who traveled to London for the court proceedings against the British government. They really wanted to meet the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, and they seemed to be fans. What do you make of that?
It's a great question, and I was there with them in London during the context of the trial happening at a few different moments in time. And they desperately wanted to have an audience with the Queen. And when they were given an opportunity to visit around London and the rest that they wanted, the first place they wanted to go and see is Buckingham Palace. Now recall, her portrait hung in every detention camp in Kenya. They were forced to sing God Save the Queen. And I think it gets to sort of some of the real complexities about the impact of colonialism and British imperial rule, which is the internalization of British power structures, the reverence for the monarchy, and the sense in these claimants' case that they were coming to London to seek justice from Her Majesty. Now, obviously, it's Her Majesty's government who they are suing. But really, for some of them, in their minds, it was to the Queen herself who was going to be the arbiter of justice. Yes, there were terrible things that were done. And at the same time, Her Majesty is still who we look to as our symbolic head of state.
Do you yourself watch these costume dramas like The Crown or Bridgerton?
Oh, all the time. I can't get enough of them. I'm a Netflix junkie.
How do you explain their appeal? I mean, the enduring appeal of British royalty and the monarch. I mean, and that too across the world, really.
Make no mistake. There is not a single thing that came about with empire, monarchy and nation, and the role of monarchy in projecting it, that was not carefully choreographed, stylized, projected. The monarchy's power flows from two main sources, the Church of England and the Empire. And so I think in that sense, this sense of an establishment, if you will, an institution that is greater and higher than all of us. And the degree to which we as viewers internalize this, the degree to which, you know, the claimants in that Mau Mau High Court case that you referenced internalized it. And I think in that sense, I think we're at a crossroads when we think about sort of ultimately the Queen passing in future years and what happens to the monarchy behind that. But make no mistake, the monarchy has been exceptional in reinventing and inventing itself and maintaining its hold on these two sources of sort of the two wellsprings of power. So when you watch, you know, The Crown, loved it, watched it. I watched Queen Victoria. I watched all of it. I'm actually looking for how these things are choreographed and how we understand and how the monarchy is projected. And it's you have to respect it for being an incredible operation in maintaining its allure, maintaining its mystique, and most importantly, of maintaining its sense of symbolic power.
As someone who studies empires, I know you focus on the British Empire, but where would you place the U.S.? Where are we in our arc?
Well, you know, I think as somebody who studies empires, the story is not good. We are certainly, I would see us in decline and rapidly declining. You know, obviously we've got one of the largest, you know, the largest economy in the world. And yet at the same time, there are certain markers that we look for, Arun. If we look at the nature of, for example, the education level and health of our workforce, you know, do we have skilled and healthy labor? If you look at the nature by which our literacy rates, our math literacy rates, you know, if you look at all these kinds of benchmarks, we are so far behind. We're behind countries in the global south. When we think about sort of the move towards sort of socioeconomic rights, what we know, and this kind of sort of brings us in the realm of business, you know, colleagues of mine at Harvard Business School, Michael Porter and Jan Rifkin, write about, you know, how do countries stay competitive? Well, they stay competitive through growth and shared prosperity. And if you look at the nature in which we are missing the latter dramatically in the United States, it begs the question of where are we as an empire? We're certainly an informal empire. We have been for many years. You'd be hard-pressed not to see us in decline. You'd also be hard-pressed not to see us as tacking behind, if you will, certain global South countries on certain benchmarks.
Caroline Elkins, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much, Arun.
Caroline Elkins is the author of Legacy of Violence, A History of the British Empire. She spoke with our guest interviewer, Arun Venugopal. Arun is a senior reporter for the WNYC Race and Justice Unit. After we take a short break, David Bianculli will review The Return of Better Call Saul. The final handful of episodes begins airing tonight. This is Fresh Air.